Hello, listeners. This is Accents, a podcast hosted by WUKY. This episode has been brought to you by Kentucky Humanities and the Kentucky Book Festival. I am your host, Katerina Stoikova, and my guest today is writer Fenton Johnson. Hi, Fenton. How are you doing today?
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
I'm so excited to be talking to you today out of all days. Specifically because it's the day before you're going to be inducted into the Kentucky Writers Hall of Fame. What does it feel like?
Well, I'm kind of a shy and retiring sort of guy, and it's a little bit uncomfortable. I was talking with two people in Bardstown that I was interviewing as part of a project, and somehow we got off on the subject of awards. They brought it up, and somebody else brought up the awards ceremony that is coming and said, oh, he's in town because he's being named to the Kentucky Writer Hall of Fame. And I said, yeah, that's true. And one of the men very sympathetically said, you know, just think of yourself as a kind of sacrificial lamb, that you're there to bring everybody together in celebration, and that's your purpose. And I said, I like that. You know, I like the fact that the Carnegie Center has created this event. Now, perhaps more important than at any time since its creation, where readers and thoughtful people and writers can come together and celebrate the fact that we are here in the face of a historical moment. These times come and they go, we know this, but right now they seem to be upon us, where there's a lot of hostility toward that the old American anti-intellectual thing seems to have been given free rein. So I'm really glad to be participating in it. That is just a delight. And then, of course, to have one's name on a list of names that is so distinguished, many of whom have been deeply influential in my own work, several of whom are old friends, lifelong friends, that's all very wonderful. And I can't praise the Carnegie Center and Tom Eblen and the staff there for putting this together and making it available to Kentucky writers and readers.
I don't miss it. Whenever I'm in town, you know, whenever I'm in the country, I don't miss it. It's really wonderful celebration, and I hope it continues for many, many years. What were you doing when you found out you were being inducted into the Hall of Fame?
I was writing.
You were writing. What could be better? Yeah.
Tell people that, you know, people will ask, what is your writing process? And the reader only sees the final product, and it seems more or less organized and, you know, well put together or whatever. That's what they see. My writing process is, I compare it to, there's a pig, and I need to get it across the fence. And the pig has been not being very cooperative. It's a pig, after all. It's running around and whatever. But also, the fence keeps moving. So I spend 5 minutes or an hour or a morning or a week or a month struggling with getting this pig across the fence. And finally, I get the pig on the other side of the fence with the fence, the pig, and me all considerably worse for the wear. And then I look back and there's another pig to get across the fence. And that's writing. You know, it's this continual series of pigs across the fence. So I was in the middle of a pig across the fence moment. And the nice thing about it was it was a Friday. And I got two calls simultaneously. One was from, and I forget which came first, but one was from Bill Goodman at the Humanities Council saying that the Humanities Council had chosen Scissors, Paper, Rock, my second novel, as the statewide Kentucky Reads book. And then, apparently completely unrelated, they did not consult with each other at all. A couple of hours later, Tom Eblin called and said, you know, congratulations, you've been inducted to the Kentucky Writer Hall of Fame. So the fact of those two arriving on the same day was poignant and sweet.
Sounds like a red letter day to me.
It was a good day. We take them where we can get them in this writing life.
The metaphor, the fence, the pig and me, across the fence, or getting the pig across the fence, I have to tell you, to me that sounds like a title of a craft book.
Getting the pig across the fence.
Yeah, I mean, title mm-hmm. of a craft book, because, you know, looking at your books, looks like that might be the next logical thing to do.
Yeah. Well, I've never been a really big fan of craft books, because probably just because I'm so, to continue with the barnyard metaphors, I'm so bullheaded that I can't take advice from anybody. And even, you know, to read about writing is to me a little bit like reading about swimming. You know, the way that you learn to swim is you jump in the pool. People who say to me, what's a good book about writing craft that I can read? I say, go find a really good author. Read everything they wrote in a short period of time, and very intensive reading, and keep a pen and a notebook at hand. And when you see something that they did that you really like, say to yourself, how did they get the pig across the fence? You know, I'll give an example.
I'm sorry. I'm just going to put a parenthesis here, and I say that's chapter one of your craft book. Please continue.
Yeah, I'll give an example, which is in Scissors, Paper, Rock, the central chapter, which is called Scissors, Paper, Rock, is a big family picnic, and there are many family, there's a cast of many characters, and you've met them individually in chapters, but now they've all come together for a family reunion. And there are a lot of logistical challenges. Managing many characters at the same time, how do you do that? You know, how do you keep the reader's focus on the character that you want it to be, or you want the reader to be paying attention to, at the same time that you give the impression of a lot of activity that's going on in the background? And the two places that I turned for that were James Joyce's brilliant story, The Dead, where he has a Christmas party. And I literally took The Dead, propped it open with a brick on the desk, and every time I got to a place where I had to figure out how to get a character off stage and on stage, I would look at Joyce. I didn't steal the literal sentences, but how did he do this? You know, how does he create a sense of many characters, yet keeping the focus on one character? And one thing that I learned was he uses sound a lot, which is not something you really think about when you're in the quiet, silent world of prose. But when you read Joyce, upstairs there's dancing going on, you hear the feet pounding on the floor, you hear the music playing. So there's always a sense that, oh, there's a big crowd up there. And downstairs you hear the cutlery clinking in the kitchen and the knives. And so there's all these people that are downstairs. So you have a sense of a crowd, even as the particular scene is focused on two people's exchange. So I looked at that. And the other person I looked at was the choreography of George Balanchine. Because what Balanchine did so well, how he revolutionized dance, was before Balanchine, you'd have this big core of dancers around the edges of the stage, and they were just there as kind of decoration, you know, furniture. And yet Balanchine realized these are all people who have been through years and years of training. They're all extraordinarily talented people. Why aren't we using them? And so Balanchine created choreography where you had the core, the members of the core, coming onto the stage, enormously complex choreography. And I would look at how Balanchine, I mean, literally watch a Balanchine dances, and I would look at, so how does he get this dancer who's back over here in the corner, how does he bring that person forward? And then in the writing of that chapter, visualize the yard, the backyard of this house, as a stage where I have people who are moving on and off the stage as if they are dancers in a Balanchine a Balanchine dance. So those are two examples of looking at how another artist or another writer faced with the same challenge, how did they grapple with this challenge? And so when someone says, can you recommend a craft book that addresses the question or engages the challenge of moving around a lot of characters, I say, go find a writer that you really admire and look at how they did it, and then reinterpret that in your own way to make it your own.
I've always thought that reading great writers is learning by osmosis, yes. Even if you don't know what you're looking for.
Yes. It's a little like I'm working completely different world in my head right now, but through various circumstances, because I speak French reasonably well. I'm working with a refugee in upstate New York now who is from Guinea, and he speaks his native tribal language, but he also speaks French. And I'm the only person, one of the only people around who can communicate with him. And I keep saying to him, I know you don't feel like you're learning English. I gave him a set of headphones for his for the iPhone that somebody else had given him. And I said, now these headphones are magic. And he said, what do you mean? And I said, they only work when you're listening to English. You cannot listen to it because I don't want you plugging into French radio programs. I want you to listen to English all the time because you don't think that you're learning it, but you're still absorbing the rhythm, the cadence, the syllables that are there, the way the language measures itself out is you're still absorbing that in some level. You still have to study, and you still have to make a lot of mistakes. Those are the only ways to learn a language. But you need to be listening to music, and reading a lot of a really good writer is like that. You know, you're going to absorb it. I do think that every serious writer that I know does develop a discipline of when they read someone that they're taking seriously, they keep a notebook and they, you know, I will write out long passages by hand because I have a personal mythology. I don't think it's just a mythology. I think there's some real empirical basis to it, but I will write out, I write it out by hand because I feel like if I write it out by hand that my body is learning it in some way or another because of the physicality of the gesture of handwriting, that if I typed it or if I took a photograph of it and stored it in my computer or whatever, I could do those things. But I wouldn't absorb it in a way that when I write it out
by hand. Too ephemeral.
Yeah, exactly. And writing it out by hand is to use a Christian word, it's an incarnational gesture. It embodies something which is otherwise abstract.
Well, you mentioned incarnational Christian terminology. So I'm going to pass forward a few questions and go there. You have been connected to people of faith since birth, or even before birth, you know, because of the story of your name. What does it mean for a skeptic to keep faith?
Well, you ask a very good question. It arises out of my fourth book, I guess, a nonfiction book called Keeping Faith, A Skeptic's Journey Among Christian and Buddhist Monks, where that book started because I found that I was so angry at institutionalized religion that I figured that I had to deal with that anger in some way or another or otherwise, because it was clear that the anger was dealing with me. It was clear that the anger was in control of me. So I decided, as a way to go about that I would I would compare contrast two radically different traditions, American Buddhism and American Christianity, and that my means to that end is that I would live in monasteries, Christian and Buddhist monasteries, over a period of years, not for periods ranging from a week to at the longest, I think maybe a month. And I would talk to people, and I would follow the practices. And at the end of that time, I would either say, see, you're right, these people are all, this is all just BS, and you have every right to your anger. Or maybe I would grow somewhere. And the latter, maybe not surprisingly because of the nature of reading and writing and also getting to know people, turned out to be the case, and it was an extraordinary experience. One thing that I learned was that it's a real mistake to do as we do in English, which is to use the words faith and religion interchangeably. So that somebody, I recall an instance, I was looking for a publicist for that book, and someone referred me to one of the leading publicists in the San Francisco Bay Area, who did pro bono work for nonprofit organizations, who wouldn't work for large corporations, who generously contributed her time to causes that she believed in, and I was really delighted at the prospect of working with her. And I called her up, and we had a close mutual friend in common. I called her up and described the book, and she said, you know, I can't represent your book. And I said, why not? And she said, I'm not a person of faith. And I said, you sound like the very definition of a person of faith to me. And it was the writing of the book that taught me that. This was somebody who was constantly taking leaps into the unknown as a gesture of faith, of confidence. In French, you would often use the word confidence instead of faith. And in fact, in Pali, which is the modern language of Tibetan Buddhism, there is no word for faith. The word that they translate, when they translate the word faith from English into Pali, the word they use is confidence. So this is someone who has confidence that this gesture, which doesn't make any sense, giving away your time for free for a risky proposition with a struggling nonprofit organization, is going to resonate into the world in a way that is affirming and contributes to the growing good of the world. That, to me, is a gesture of faith. Whether the person darkens the door of a church or a mosque or a temple is some of the greatest people of faith that I know never darken the door of a church or a mosque or a temple. But they're still great people of faith. And that's what I would say. I separate that. You won't find me ever saying, as one hears all the time in American media, the faiths, this person subscribes to the Roman Catholic faith. I say this person subscribes to the Roman Catholic religion, which is a different matter, and it's not a value-laden judgment. It's just religion is the architecture of dogma and doctrine and whatever that can be, not always, but can be a vehicle for faith. But faith is the gesture that allows you to write a poem, to write a book, to raise a child, to enter onto an undertaking without any certainty of the outcome, and in fact, an undertaking that any sensible person might say to you, "Why are you doing this? You know, why spend your time doing this? Why spend your time writing poetry? Why spend your time reading poetry?" These are gestures of faith, I think. And there is a sense of faith that this gesture is participating in the weaving of a kind of cloth that constitutes community, virtue. These are all comprised of these gestures. Does that resonate? Does that make sense to you?
It absolutely does. I don't want to talk about myself, and it's not about me. Well, I'm going to say a few things because of prompted by what you said is I grew up in an atheist country. I was brought up atheist. Mm-hmm. And then in my 30s, I found my own connection to higher power, and I constructed my own connection with higher power, experiential. However, I consider it, and that might piss off my listeners, but there it is, I consider it a great fortune that happened to me, that I actually had to form and make my own relationship with spirit. And I did not get plugged into the matrix of a religion.
Buddhism has a very lovely metaphor, which I quote in that particular book, Keeping Faith. You come to a river, and there is a canoe on the bank of the river, and you use the canoe to cross the river. You get to the other side. When you get to the other side, you don't pick up the canoe and take it with you. You leave the canoe on the bank of the river for someone else to use. And Buddhism says that the architecture of doctrine and dogma is the canoe. And it's something that you can use to cross the river. Other people might just swim across the river without a boat at all. It's a good metaphor that way to get further on their journey. But the canoe is not to be confused with the process of crossing the river. The canoe is an architecture of doctrine and dogma, and it can be useful for some people. It can also be, as we see over and over, very pernicious and very harmful for a lot of people. So one has to have the independence of thought to form one's own relationship with it, to use what is useful and not to have any compunctions or qualms about throwing away that which is not useful or even harmful.
I wrote a book called How God Punishes. I wrote it first in Bulgarian, and I published it in Bulgaria, and it did great. The book did great there. It's largely atheist country, okay? Mm-hmm. Then I translated and published it here with the same title, with absolute crickets.
Uh-huh. Well, that could have to do with, it doesn't, I mean...
Could be a terrible book, you know?
No. That's not what I was about to say. I was about to say that I'm not the only person to say this, but, you know, I've been fortunate enough that I have not traveled extensively compared to some people, but I've traveled a fair amount. I've spent quite a bit of time in France. I've spent some time in India. I have been in Mexico for not infrequently when I was living in Tucson, teaching in Tucson. I've been in other Western European countries a little bit, or a fair amount. In Canada, I've been around. One of the reasons that it is so delightful to leave the United States is that in every country in the world, when I say I'm a writer, people say, wow, that's so cool, that's so great. In the United States, when I say I'm a writer, people invariably say, but what do you really do? And I say, well, I'm really a writer. Well, you can't make a living doing that. Like, what do you really do? And I say, well, actually, I've kind of made a living doing a writer, being a writer. And then they say, are you famous? That is the American conversation, which I never have in any other country. There's, you know, it's, I've said what it is that I do. It is a calling that people admire and respect in and of itself. It doesn't have to justify itself by fame or money or, you know, whatever. So when you say the book didn't do well in the United States, what I want to say is that could be a problem with the United States, not a problem with the book. Don't you think? And poetry in particular. I mean,
that doesn't help for sure.
I know. And I, you know, I'll tell another that's kind of a funny story. I like telling the story because I feel I tell it to my students. So I had I was in my mid-30s, I guess, and I became good friends, a lifelong friend, a wonderful friendship with a wonderful writer named Pam Houston. It was a really excellent book about women's rights and what's being done to women's rights in this country coming out in another few months. At any rate, Pam, at some point, I forget who it was I was reading, I came across, maybe it was Whitman or, I don't know, a pretty well-known poet. And I passingly said to Pam, oh, you know, I've kind of gotten back into reading poetry these days. And Pam, without missing a beat and a total lack of affect, said, of course you read poetry. You're a writer. And I thought, yeah, she's right. And the fact that I hadn't been in that place was entirely about the American educational system and the sense in America that poetry is something that is a luxury and that is only indulged in by a few people who are, you know, surrounding themselves with bouquets of lilies and writing with lace curtains and on a beautiful day in spring. And in fact, you know, those of us who read poetry know that in many cultures of the world, often in some of the most oppressed cultures in the world, poetry has been and continues to be a lifeline.
Absolutely. The poets are the heroes of the nation.
Yes. I wish that we would realize that more in the United States. I mean, one of the things that's so pernicious about, I have to mention this, the current Kentucky attack, legislature's attack on LGBT people is, you know, Walt Whitman, to name the most prominent example, Whitman taught us how to be an American. We didn't know what it was. The country was trying to figure out what it was. All it was at that point, frankly, was a bunch of, you know, white Europeans who had come over to kill the natives and take their lands away from them. And Whitman was really the person who said, we have a noble calling and I'm going to describe it for you. He really gave us what it means to be an American. And we don't teach that. You know, we don't. He's a sideline if he's taught at all in American letters.
Speak about your relationship with Kentucky.
Well, you know, I don't want to dig it out, but I have a wonderful quotation from James Baldwin. James Baldwin, the great African American prophet, I call him because he really was. He began preaching in the church when he was 11, and his writing, like the writing of another Protestant background preacher, Wendell Berry, always has the cadence and the kind of inevitability of a kind of extraordinarily eloquent sermon. Baldwin grew up in Harlem. This is the 100th anniversary, 100th year of his birth. And I've organized a project where I have 10 really wonderful people, and we're spending the year reading our way through Baldwin. We meet once a month on Zoom, and we talk about the latest Baldwin book that we've read. And in, I'm not sure it's Fire Next Time or Nobody Knows My Name, but he has a very eloquent statement about how, even though by that point he has returned to living in France, and he lived in France for the last 20 years of his life, after having lived there for some 12 years when he was young, he tried coming back to the United States, and the perniciousness of the racism and homophobia in the United States drove him back to France. But his roots were always in Harlem, and he says, if you've got a home, you had better hold on to it, because if you don't hold on to it, you're going to be homeless. He says something like, in whatever bitterness of memory, I will always love that place more deeply and more profoundly than any other place. Kentucky is such a rich and it's got such a rich, complicated background, as we are discovering, if we have the courage to face it, more and more a pretty dark background in the 19th century, and prior to that, we are gradually disabusing ourselves of elaborate myths that were created in order to shore up and decorate the history of white people in the state. It's a privilege to be a part of that, not because I'm thumbing my nose at anybody, but just because the truth will set you free. The truth shall set you free. And to uncover the layers of deception and reveal the beautiful gem that lies underneath is, I think, a writer's responsibility, an artist's responsibility. So there is this complex relationship. Both sides of my family have been in Kentucky since the 1780s. And one side of the family was, worked for liberation of the slaves, and the other side of the family enslaved people. They're both there. I have relatives who are mixed race people who were born to members of the family on one side of the family. So and all of this I've discovered in the last couple of years. It was known, but it was never talked about. And I've uncovered it in the last couple of years. So just from a writer's point of view, if you've got material that complex, why would you go anywhere else? I mean, that's part of it. But I'll finish up my typically long-winded answer by saying it's a really interesting observation that I have made to myself and that my writing has revealed to me. It wasn't a conscious decision on my part. The writing revealed to me that my nonfiction is all over wherever I've been. I have nonfiction set in New York, nonfiction set in France, nonfiction set in India, California, wherever. But my fiction is always set in Kentucky. And that to me is, there's something really telling about that, that the deepest imaginative world, the world of the imprinted world, the world of the interior life, the foundation of that world is Kentucky, I think. So I have to ask this question because I like these as conversations. What is the relationship between Bulgaria and Kentucky? Do you find yourself writing about, gradually moving into Kentucky, or is it still, you still find your writing mostly set in Bulgaria?
I wasn't going to inflict that upon you, but it will be an honor to give you as a gift my new poetry book, Between a Birdcage and a Birdhouse, in which is a love letter to America, breakup letter with America. It's the interrogation of, should I stay, should I go? What does it feel like to be home, to be at home, and where is home? And what it's like to feel different everywhere you go.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the topics in my work that has been since the beginning, since I actually started writing in English. I've been writing since I was 8 years old, first in Bulgarian, and then when I turned 24, I immigrated, and then I wrote. No, and I didn't write for 11 years. And then I all of a sudden started writing in English, and then I guess both languages balanced out after a few years. Why I'm saying all this, Kentucky is my sixth state. Before that, I lived in Ohio, California, New York State, Virginia, North Carolina, and then once I stepped into Kentucky, something came back to me, which was writing, something that I had forsaken for so long, and I didn't feel like myself, because I feel like there are certain people who are born with the need to write and share, and it's as important as breathing. And I'm sure you understand. And I had exiled that part of me at the same time as I left one country. And mind you, I didn't leave a good situation. I had to leave. Coming to Kentucky and starting to write again, that gave me an opportunity to be myself and to be whole and to give my gifts.
Well, your thoughts point to an interesting aspect of Kentucky, which is, even though, as I say, that description of the typical attitude toward writing and poetry that one encounters in the United States versus other countries applies in Kentucky as much as it applies elsewhere, there is still here, it seems to me, a kind of affection and a kind of respect given to writers and readers. I don't know if it's fading with time. It might be. I that would be something that I wouldn't be the best person to speak to because of having been gone for a great deal. I do come back a lot, for a lot of reasons. My mother lived to be 101 years old, and she died in 2017. You know, who knew that she was going to live that long? But I had an academic job that allowed me to come back a semester a year, and so I came back and was living in with her in her house in southern Nelson County, New Haven. And then I've always made a big point of I've never been away for, I don't know, the longest period of time I've been away from Kentucky is probably 6 or 8 months, I suppose, without coming back for a visit. I sort of detoured to an issue that I've been confronted with, and that's been a little challenging. There are people in Kentucky who feel that, who have expressed the point of view that unless you are living here, that you cannot write about the place. This does not acknowledge the rich history of literature by people who are in one degree or another in exile. With James Baldwin, you know, our most eloquent writing really about America in the 20th century, I would say, certainly among the most eloquent, is by Baldwin, who spent most of that time living in France. You have James Joyce, who never went back to Dublin, left Dublin, never returned, and wrote about it for the rest of his life. You have Dante, if you want to go back, that far back, who was exiled from Florence and never got to return there. There's a long history of that, and it's the difference between the perspective of someone who is immersed in the place, the very literal fact of the place, and someone who is looking from afar, and they're each valuable perspectives. They're different perspectives. One could argue that they are complementary perspectives. But certainly the perspective of somebody who is writing about a place from afar is an extraordinarily valuable perspective. I would say, for the richest imaginable exploration of what it means to have a home and what home means, I would say James Baldwin. His work is so, his sense of his deep affection for the United States at the same time that his utterly unromanticized, realistic confrontation with its racism, its obsession with violence, its anti-intellectualism. That tension is always present in his work, and I know of no other person who, of the 20th century, you could put Wendell in that. It'd be an interesting doctoral thesis to compare James Baldwin and Wendell Berry, but in their writings about home. Somebody who did come back and lived in the place, Wendell, contrasted to someone like Baldwin, who lived in Europe and was writing about it from afar.
I have a quote by you. "I believe in writing as a means of advancing truth and justice. I believe that as well, but I also believe in writing as a means of a connection to one's self and as a means of making sense of things and events. Do you agree?"
Yes. The word, I stumble a little bit over the word sense, because sometimes what writing reveals is the senselessness of things, you ought to be able to learn something from your writing. If you can't, no one else can. And it is always the challenge for me is to listen to what the writing is trying to teach me. And what typically happens in the early drafts of a piece is that I'm trying to tell the story what it wants to be, instead of listening to the story telling me what it wants to be. And once I beat myself into submission by hours in the chair and hours at the desk and too many drafts thrown away and whatever, and begin to really listen to the story, I do think that, can I say this? I believe in an ordered universe. There is, if you want to call it God, you can call that. Part of the product of writing Keeping Faith is that I no longer object to the use of the word God. Use whatever you could use. I had a character who told a monk, "How about, instead of using the word, I don't like the word God, how about if you say my Ford 150 pickup truck?" And so every time the monk is using the word God, he substitutes Ford 150 pickup truck. It's just a word. It's a placeholder. What it stands for me is the sense that there is an order in the universe that I often don't perceive, that I usually don't perceive, and sometimes lose faith in. But writing, which is based in grammar and syntax, which is based in something that extends far deep into the past, it extends as far back as animals communicating with each other through whatever means they used, it has an inherent order, and it has a syntax, it has a grammar, it has a structure. And putting what I'm trying to say into that ordered world enables me to access and to perceive the larger order that I had lost track of. I give an example. I try to give this example a lot because it's very meaningful to and very important. I did a lot of study as part of the current project the great American black writer, Frederick Douglass, the enslaved until he was 18 or thereabouts, maybe a little younger, ran away, became the great orator of the middle 19th and late 19th century, certainly was instrumental in persuading Lincoln to issue the Emancipation Proclamation, et cetera, et cetera. And we get to the end of what is often called the Civil War, but which I am calling the War of Emancipation. 1865, 1867, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments to the Constitution are passed, and slavery is by and large ended, and civil rights are given to black men, not yet women, but men. And Frederick Douglass must have thought at that point that the glory days had come. You know, but who could have imagined when he was a slave in 1845 that he would live to see this moment? Then, across the next 40 years, Jim Crow laws are put in place, lynching, black people are lynched all over the South. There is generalized approval of lynching. Congress refuses to pass an anti-lynching bill over and over. And at the time that he died in 1890, he said things are very bleak for black people right now in this country. So does that mean that everything that Frederick Douglass did in the first half of his life was pointless and useless? No, it means that there is an arc of justice, as Martin Luther King would say, that is longer than we can live through and perceive. And our job is to have faith. There's that important word, that arc is there, even when we can't see it being acted out, and to do what we can in our particular moment in history to move that arc forward, even when it seems as if our efforts are not producing any results, even if it seems a very dark moment in history. We have to have faith in that order. And to bring it back to writing, I think what writing does, because of the reasons that I mentioned, because one has to confront the challenge of communication, of reaching across the gap between you and me, between me and the stranger, between me and the refugee, between me and the person in West Africa or Venezuela or wherever. And writing makes us confront and engage that, and that can be a means to accessing that curve, that arc of movement of energy toward justice. That's what I want to believe. There are certainly dark moments. Now might be one of them. Where it's very hard to believe that. But then I look at the model of people like Frederick Douglass or Sojourner Truth or Harriet Tubman or, I could name him Harvey Milk. I could name him any number of people who, in some cases, literally gave their lives for that arc. And I say, my job is to measure up to the bar that they set.
Tell us about the relationship between solitude and creative life.
Well, you're invoking the subject of my last book, which was called At the Center of All Beauty, Solitude and the Creative Life. Speaking of poetry, it gives me an opportunity to recite a short Frank O'Hara poem, which is the source of the title of the book. The poem is called by Frank O'Hara, gay man, died, maybe murdered on the beach at 40 years old, on Long Island, in any case, died under mysterious circumstances at 40 years old in 1964. the poem is called Autobiographia Literaria, or Literary Autobiography, and the poem goes, when I was a child, I played by myself in a corner of the schoolyard all alone. I hated dolls, and I hated games. Animals were not friendly. Birds flew away. When anyone came looking for me, I hid behind a tree and cried out, "I am an orphan." Now, here I am, the center of all beauty, writing these poems. Imagine. And I love that little poem because the last line is just that one word, imagine, with an exclamation point. And the easiest and the most obvious interpretation is imagine the journey of this poet from the place alone on the schoolyard to the place where he's writing these beautiful poems. But the last line is also an imperative. It's a command to us. Imagine, you know, it is, he's telling us, imagine. Yeah. And I really like that, you know. It's very, so the creative act, I think, you know, even collective, even communal creative acts begin in solitude. Even a choreographer works at home alone. An actor spends a lot of, you know, the most communal of undertakings, theater, still spends a lot of time alone at home memorizing lines. A playwright, of course, is a writer or at home alone. And yet the writing achieves its fulfillment in being read. Now, I want to be clear in saying, you notice that I didn't say the writing achieves its fulfillment in being published, because a lot of people never have their work published. But what I do think, that even for, let's say, Emily Dickinson, another of my favorites, I'd like to be creative and original and choose somebody, but Emily Dickinson is great, so why not? And her poems are really easy to memorize. Who was, you know, famously our solitaire. Well, in fact, Emily Dickinson led a very lively social life. She engaged with her family. She engaged the neighbors. She was a voluminous correspondent, wrote many letters, surveyed the world from her apartment, southeast-facing room in the house, looking out over the main street of Amherst, watching the life of the community come and go. We don't think about her in those terms. But she read her poems. Other people read her poems. She submitted them gave them to people far more than the myth would have to be the case. And you have to think that there is some sort of a romantic notion that we have to have reinforced about, she, you know, sat up in the garret all by herself, all alone, all the time. In fact, she was a lovely and social person. So getting back to your question, somebody said at some point that creativity happens when we're alone because God is, you know who it was? It was Abraham Heschel, the great Jewish theologian who was an active participant in the Civil War struggles of the 1960s. He said, God is alone. God needs people in order to, God is in need of you because God is not completed until through the human presence, you know. I thought that was an interesting idea. I think creativity begins in solitude and then it achieves its fulfillment through someone else. The reader can be your next door neighbor. It can be your poetry group. It can be whoever it is, but it doesn't have to be a million people. But it achieves itself in some kind of community. It achieves its fulfillment in some kind of community. But it still begins in the solitude of the heart.
What you said made me think of Marcus Aurelius and his meditations. So you never know who will be reading and how long after the work has been written.
Yes. And also, we don't, the fact, I tell my students this, and it's really true. especially in this country, we give all the focus on the publication. And maybe this is a way of circling back to your initial question about what do I feel about the Writers Hall of Fame. It's a great excuse, a lovely excuse. I'm really privileged and honored to be the catalyst, one of several, for bringing these people, this group of wonderful people together. It'll be a really great energy. I know that much, I know for sure. But writing is about the process of writing. One had better, however painful it can be, getting that pig across the fence, one had better enjoy struggling with the pig, because finally the writing achieves its fulfillment in the process of writing. It enlarges your heart to do this. The struggle enlarges the heart. And in a way, it doesn't matter. It's nice when it's published. It's nice if it gets a reward. It's nice if it sells lots of copies. It's nice if you get people who say that's a wonderful book. All that is really great. But the process of growth comes in the writing. Just as if you are, let's say, I try to find metaphors in the body, because that's what we have. If you're a gymnast or a dancer and you practice, you rehearse assiduously, you're going to become a better gymnast and a better dancer. Does it matter that you make the team, you go to the Olympics, you win a medal? All that's great. But you're still going to be a really great gymnast. And the discipline of working whatever your practice is, it is going to shape you into a better person. And because it shapes you into a better person, it's going to make for a better world. I really believe that. I'm friends with the members of the Kronos Quartet, which is a really well-known new music quartet out of San Francisco, very groundbreaking. And one of them just announced his retirement. And the person who was interviewing him in that particular story said, what are you going to do? The group has its final concert in June. What are you going to do? You know, you've been doing this for 55 years. What are your 50 years? What are you going to do the first day after the concert is over? And he said, I'll get up and rehearse. And I thought, yep, that is the right answer, you know. It's a discipline that one inhabits, and through that discipline gives form to the world. Here's a line that my writing taught me. It's in I don't know which book it's in, but it's one of those things that when I wrote it, I thought, I look back at it afterwards, usually months later, and say, wow, I didn't know I knew that. And the line was, life is like water. It takes the shape of the vessel into which it is poured. Remove the vessel and it's lost. And writing is, for the writer, the vessel into which the life is poured. For a dancer, dance would be that vessel. For a farmer, farming. Gardener, gardening would be the vessel. The vessel can be made of any number of disciplines or combination, but it is the discipline that shapes the vessel.
You know, that makes a lot of sense to me, because whenever I'm between projects, between writing projects, I feel lost and miserable.
Yes. Well, there's this terrible phenomenon, which I'm kind of in the middle of right now, which is, I'm mad at myself when I'm not writing, and then I get into a project and I'm mad at myself because the project is not going very well.
Well, you're wrestling with the pig.
Yeah, when wrestling with the pig, and I have to remind myself, you know, It's scary to say this. I when I say this, I fear that the goddess is going to come down and strike me dead or, you know, visit me with writer's block. But in a way, I don't really believe in writer's block, because you go long periods in which you don't write, or you go long periods in which everything that you write is crappy and you throw it away. And it's very frustrating. But that's not writer's block. It's just writing. That's the process. Sometimes it comes, sometimes it doesn't.
Seasonal.
You know, I was saying out loud to myself in the car this morning when I was thinking about, you know, what I might say this evening's event. A baseball player who bats 300, that is to say, who gets a hit 30% of the time that he goes to bat, is a really hot baseball player. 300 is a really, really good batting average. So you look at that and you say, that means that 70% of the time that he goes to the plate, he strikes out. He doesn't get a hit. 70-30 for quote-unquote failure success, I think that's a, you know, that's a pretty good percentage. And yet, we sit down to write, and if every page we produce is not, you know, flawless or showing promise of being so, we feel like, you know, that we're not being quote-unquote successful.
I'm just going to say that again, that I do hope that you consider writing a book about writing. I mean, even if it's not a, quote, craft book, unquote, I have enjoyed so much hearing from you about writing, about process, about pigs and fences, that I guarantee I'm not the only one. And looking at your age as a writer and hearing all these thoughts and ideas and direction, if not advice, direction that we can take, and they are ready in you. I think that such a book can come together very quickly, and you're in search of a project, right?
No, I'm in the middle of a project, but you're right. It might be where this project is right now, it might be a good idea to step away from it and focus my attention on something else for a while and then come back to the project. You know, sometimes... sometimes you have to respect the fact that the pig that you have been wrestling with does not want to go across the fence right now, and nothing you can do is going to get it across the fence. And in fact, if you continue to struggle to get it across the fence, you're going to damage the pig and the fence and yourself beyond repair. And that's a moment, the wisdom comes in being able to say, all right, the project isn't, I haven't failed with this project. I'm going to set it aside, and when it wants to reveal itself to me, it will come back to me. And I've had that happen. I've had, there's a chapter in Scissors, Paper, Rock where I just fought with it for months, and I set it aside, and then I came back to it, and I fought with it for more months. And I just couldn't get it to work. But I knew that there was something there. And then my father died. There was the emotional catharsis surrounding attending anyone's death, but particularly your father's. And I came back to the desk. It was the death of my lover. It was the death of my partner in France, and there was all the drama and the trauma around that. And then eventually, several months later, I said to myself, "Well, you have to face the blank page again. That's your calling. That's your job. You have to do that, no matter how hard it is. But I'm not going to challenge myself to write something from scratch. That's too daunting. I'll take up an old project and I'll look at that." And I pulled this project that I'd tried twice before and spent months on. And I wrote it in 3 days. And it just,
as above, so below, you were ready.
Exactly. It needed all of those things to happen. It needed the moment. It needed the gestation period, you know, whatever. So I'm an extremely impatient person. And to the extent that I have learned patience, to the extent that I have learned, it's because writing has taught me patience. And that is an enormous gift. I wish that I could have come by it organically, but that's not my character.
Well, it's hard earned.
Yes, yes, exactly. Well, you know, I don't want to say no pain, no gain, but the fact of the matter is that the measure of the reward is in some measure determined by the measure of the commitment that you bring to the project. And you know, if you take something casually, you can you'll get a casual result, and there's nothing wrong with that. But committing oneself in a more open-ended way does not always produce results. There is the mysterious thing, the very mysterious and frustrating thing called, you know, talent. You know, where you just, some people, you know, Baryshnikov comes immediately to mind. But you know, the man worked and worked and worked. Dance was his life. And yet, he also had some kind of intuitive understanding of dance that was just a gift, you know, and a remarkable gift.
What is the most important thing you teach your students? If you want them to remember one thing from your class or workshop, what is it?
Well, I won't think about it very long. I'll give you two answers that have been very meaningful to me. The first word of the rule of Saint Benedict, which is the rule, the governing rule of Western monasticism, the first word written in roughly 750 or thereabouts in the Christian era, the first word is listen. And I think that's a really important word for a writer to bear in mind. And the other comes from Zen Buddhism. It's nice to get two different traditions. A famous story of Suzuki Roshi, who brought Zen Buddhism. It was already there, but he really was the force behind bringing Zen Buddhism to California, to the West Coast in the 1970s. And someone once asked him to define Zen Buddhism in 10 words. And being a good Zen Buddhist, he took two words: everything changes. And those two, listen and everything changes, those are, can't do any better than that.
These are brilliant. Yeah. Thank you so much. It's been
well,
a privilege.
Well, it's been a lot of fun.